Welcome back to the Religious Studies Project, and we hope you've had as relaxed and enjoyable a holiday as we have. We've been talking for quite a while, Chris and I, Chris, say hello.
Hello.
And I'm David Robertson, obviously, about several changes to the format. And hey, you're listening to the first one right now. We are recording in the White Hart Inn. In the Grass Market in Edinburgh, and we figured that because we have actually recruited quite a few more interviewers for the project, that David and I should become more hosts rather than just topping and tailing the interviews and things. So we think that one of the big things we'll do now is, in a sort of relaxed environment, we shall provide a bit more of a substantial intro and outro, and a bit of a reflection on podcasts that we're presenting to you.
And, well, you've alluded there to the other big change, which is that we've enlarged the pool of interviewers quite considerably. We wanted to take the Religious Studies Project international and to cover things that Chris and I didn't know about personally enough to be able to really do good interviews or even know who was worth interviewing. So that's what we've done. And today's interview is an example of that. This interview with Dale Martin, who's a leading scholar of New Testament, although he does it from a religious studies perspective, was recorded by Jack Tsonis from Macquarie University in Australia.
It was at the AAR, the American Academy of Religion Conference in Chicago. He recorded that, and you can also find a report that Jack wrote on that conference for us on our website.
Yes, and we hope that in future Jack's going to be a big part of the team. But you're going to be meeting several new reporters over the next few weeks. Some of these are, for instance, that our friend David Wilson has done an interview for us that's coming up, and you know that's probably more or less a one-off, but other people are going to be real regular parts of the team, and you're going to be meeting them again and again. But we'll talk a little bit more about that after you've heard today's interview. Today's interview, as we said, is with Dale Martin, who's a professor at Yale. And one of the reasons I was excited about this interview is that I, although my kind of main interest is in new religious movements and that, and you know, that kind of field, I have a real love of biblical studies. But we've had this conversation lots, haven't we, Chris, about biblical studies, theology, religious studies.
I mean, when I was an undergraduate at Edinburgh, I think you took things one step further. You did the biblical studies that required a bit of Greek. And probably, did you do Hebrew as well? Or was it?
No, I chickened out of Hebrew, but I did Greek for 4 years.
Yeah, but I took Old Testament 1, New Testament 1, Old Testament 2, and New Testament 2. Which was sort of the basic intro courses that you could do without actually learning the languages. So I thoroughly enjoyed engaging with the texts as cultural artifacts, as stories that were written in a context by people. You know, even if you think the stories were inspired in some sense, they were written by people in a context, and the key distinction there is looking at them in that sense rather than looking at them in a sort of devotional or ontological sense.
And absolutely, I think that there are other important issues though about how we define religious studies as a field. First of all, looking at Christianity is an excellent way into a lot of the issues of religious studies for undergraduates and lay people, because you're not learning about something exotic, you're actually learning about something that you kind of culturally know already, and in that way some of the challenges are much greater. When you start talking about yourself and things that you maybe have taken for granted, it's much more obvious how things can be distorted, how things change over history, you know, and pointing out to people that many of the assumptions they make about the New Testament, in fact, aren't in there, tells you a lot more about the way that religious traditions develop, in our culture. And a second one would be actually, though, that the removal of studies of the New Testament of Christianity from religious studies are part of the problem about our defining our discipline, because if we don't look at the New Testament at Christianity, and then we are simply everything else.
Yeah.
And this is the problem. If we allow theology to take over biblical studies, then we kind of beggar religious studies, because we're not looking at the one that has the most impact. Well, I mean, I'm talking in Britain, in 2013, that the one that has the biggest cultural impact on our society.
Yeah.
And if we can't look at that, then what are we?
Yeah, because what you really end up with in religious studies is a sort of neglected majority, either of sort of devoted, we'll say devoted in quotation marks, Christians, or the sort of cultural Christians who make up the vast majority of British society become a neglected majority, in the sense that there's plenty of studies being done on minority religions in the UK, certainly, but it's very important for us to constantly be reminded of, you know, our the sort of prevalent culture itself needs to be subjected to the same rigorous questioning and that study that we do with everything else.
So let's pass over to Jack to hear his interview with Dale Martin.
All right, well, today it's my pleasure to be talking with the Woolsey Professor of Religious Studies at Yale University, Dale Martin. Dale is one of the preeminent living scholars of the New Testament and is the author of a number of books on early Christianity and the Greco-Roman world. His major works include Inventing Superstition, From the Hippocratics to the Christians, The Corinthian Body, and Slavery as Salvation, the Metaphor of Slavery in Pauline Christianity. More recently, Dale has authored a number of popularly oriented studies on Christianity and theology, including Sex and the Single Saviour, Pedagogy of the Bible, and hot off the press is his introduction to the study of the New Testament, entitled New Testament History and Literature, which is an outgrowth of his introductory course hosted by the Open Yale Courses Project. And the Open Yale Courses Project will be of interest to any students of religion wishing to firm up their knowledge on the historical study of the New Testament with a free course of study. Today, Dale and I will be discussing the intersection of biblical studies and religious studies, a topic on which he is uniquely qualified to speak. So, without further ado, Dale Martin, I'd like to thank you for talking to the Religious Studies Project.
Thank you.
So, Dale, could you perhaps begin by explaining your own academic position? You're a New Testament scholar in the Department of Religious Studies here at Yale, so you reflect the intersection that we'll be talking about today, even at the institutional level. Therefore, before we sort of come to the theoretical intersections between the fields, can you perhaps explain the nature of that relationship, both in your department and maybe across the US more broadly? Because it seems to me that biblical studies and religious studies are often substantially separated, so I'm interested to hear your thoughts on how they do relate.
It has to do with what university you're at, and especially how the different universities situate their PhD programs in religion. I did my PhD here at Yale, and the PhD here since 1963 has always been housed in the Arts and Sciences faculty, in the Graduate School of Arts and Sciences, and not, therefore, in the Divinity School, which is its own school. My PhD, therefore, was a Arts and Sciences PhD rather than a seminary degree. And then I've always taught in secular Arts and Sciences departments, too. First at Rhodes College, a small liberal arts college in Memphis, and then at Duke University, where I was also in the department, not the Divinity School there.
Sure.
And I've always enjoyed that because I do have theological interests of my own, but my scholarship has mostly, until now, been based on much more of a cultural and historical study of the New Testament documents and other early Christian documents in history. That's just what I was interested in more than the theological questions. And being in a Department of Religious Studies means that I can pursue those kinds of interests without feeling the pressure to teach people who will be future pastors. I don't have to worry about how I translate my historical scholarship into sermon material.
So it gives you a little more academic freedom.
It gives me more academic freedom. I also am very much an interdisciplinary kind of person. Mm-hmm. I like talking to people in American studies departments, anthropology, cultural studies, gender and women's studies.
Yeah, you have the literary studies department below us here on the second floor.
In the same building, we have the literature department. So being in an arts and sciences faculty in a department of religious studies and then separated, in fact, we're even geographically separated by a long 20-minute walk from the Divinity School.
Sure, and symbolic separation.
Yes, it's and we like that. We like the separation because we feel like it gives a better public face for how we're different. We're more like an English department than we are like a Divinity School.
Sure, and is there good cross-fertilization between you and the other departments? I mean, I assume you know most of the faculty from the other departments.
Yes, as a matter of fact, I'm very active in the Whitney Humanities Center.
Sure.
I've been a fellow there, which has people from all different departments, including some of the scientists. They always have some people from social sciences and natural sciences, but it's mostly people from humanities departments. I've been a fellow there. I was there, a fellow there for 3 years, and then I'm now on their executive board for a period of a couple of years.
Yep.
And that brings me in contact constantly. I serve on committees, the humanities tenure committee, and other kinds of committees with people from other departments. So I'm more connected probably to other faculty members in different departments in arts and sciences than I am to most of the Divinity School faculty, although we have good working relationships with them too.
Of course, of course. Would you say there's any tension in the methodologies between the different fields? You described just then how you take a more sort of cultural historical approach to the study of religion. Is there a tension between what goes on in the humanities versus what goes on in the Divinity School?
I don't think there's a tension. In fact, when it comes to biblical studies, I would say that more of the professors in the Divinity School actually approach the study of the Bible in fairly much a much more secular way.
Mm-hmm.
They don't, for example, most of them, even teaching in Hebrew Bible or Old Testament or New Testament, they don't actually get much into theological interpretation of these texts.
Okay.
And it's ironic that I've actually published more on theological interpretation of the Bible than most of the Divinity School professors.
Yeah, that is interesting.
But that kind of is a separate part of my, that's more my church existence mm-hmm. than it is my mm-hmm. Yale College existence.
Would you say that the ethos is similar or different between what goes on here? If there's no tension between the methodologies, is the ethos fairly similar or is there a difference there, perhaps?
Between
the Divinity School and the Religious Studies Department?
Well, yeah, it's very different. The Yale Divinity School, unlike both Chicago or Harvard, is a straightforwardly Christian divinity school.
Mm-hmm.
There are Jews there. There are, I think, some Muslims there. There are plenty of atheists and non-Christians who are in the divinity school as students. Mm-hmm. But they have chapel, and it tends mm-hmm. to be Christian, some kind of Christian type of chapel. And a lot of the people, the students, actually attend chapel.
Yeah.
So there's a definite feel at Yale Divinity School that you're in something like an interdenominational, non-denominational, but still Christian divinity school.
Mm-hmm.
That's going to be very different from either Chicago or Harvard, where you have the teaching of Buddhism, Islam, yeah. all the different major religions within the divinity schools themselves.
Yeah.
And the teaching of those kinds of subjects are in our department, not the divinity school.
Sure. Well, maybe we can begin to talk about the theoretical intersections then between religious studies and biblical studies. So, as I understand it, you begin your graduate program, the first year doctoral students, by asking them whether religion is an appropriate analytical category for studying the ancient world. So, could you first describe for us the scholars that you use to get traction on that question, and also sort of lead that into a discussion about what it actually means to historicize the category of religion?
I probably was inspired, like most of us, by Jonathan Z. Smith's writings to historicize what it is, what we mean by religion. But also I've done a lot with Tomoko Masuzawa, who's now at the University of Michigan. When she was at UNC Chapel Hill, I was at Duke, and we had a reading group together. And we were just part of what was going on generally in religious studies, where I think it's gone on for the last 30 years or so, that as we start studying religion as a comparative secular environment, people started realizing that what this thing that in the 20th century we were all taught in, I'd say, an introduction to religion course,
mm-hmm.
that religion was a social institution, a cultural institution that combined doctrine and ethics and ritual and these kinds of things. And that was a common 20th century theory of religion. And we started realizing that didn't exist in the ancient world. There was no institution that combined those things. There was no such thing as, you know, the Church of Rome in the classical world. And so basically we realized that in the ancient world, if we use the term religion, we are kind of muddying the waters, because what counts for religion for the Greeks and the Romans is simply what I call technology for dealing with the gods.
Sure.
And it didn't include ethics, and it didn't include doctrine, really. The ancient gods didn't really care what you believed about them, as long as you gave them a pig when you're supposed to give them a pig on the altar, or whatever it is that they demand. So, and when you have priests, and some, of course, ancient things we call ancient religions, they don't have priests, or set priests. So these are just technologies for dealing with the gods, and that's not what we mean in the 20th century, mm-hmm. what we meant in the 20th century by religion. We meant something much more complex than that, mm-hmm. and systematic than that. So we started trying to figure out, well, when did religion come about in the way we consider it? And different people, like my former student Brent Nongbri, with a book coming out actually very soon from Yale University Press, have traced the beginning of what we call religion to basically the colonial period or the early modern period.
Sure.
That's when people start talking about different religions that are species within a generic category of religion.
Yeah, it's not till the 16th century, I believe, that you see the plural.
Exactly. Religions. So that just means that we have to rethink this. Now, when I've done this, some of my PhD students, after spending a semester noticing this to be the case in the ancient cultures and societies, would sometimes say, well, we're not going to use the word religion anymore. We're just going to purge our vocabulary out of it. And I would say, good luck.
Yeah.
This is a concept that you probably are not going to be able to do without.
Mm-hmm.
But just noticing that it's a contingent historical concept, mm-hmm. and it's not a universal concept, it's not all the way through history, but that it's contingent to our own intellectual world, I think that's enough. Having that in mind just causes you to look at other cultures and at the ancient world in different ways.
Yeah, ask a broader set of questions.
Now, somebody could say, well, look, with someone like Philo, the Jew, Alexandrian Jew, or Josephus, or certain Jews, you do get, before Christianity, a social institution that combines ritual and ethics and things you're supposed to believe. So you could say Judaism is the closest thing in the pre-Christian world to what we mean by religion.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, somebody say, well, with Christianity, you get this also. So it becomes a matter of just how anachronistic you want to be, or just how much you want to allow. But I don't get hung up on words. For example, I don't believe that Paul, I don't think, probably even knew the word Christian.
Yeah.
He certainly didn't know Christianity.
Yeah.
And he would have rejected any term that separated out his churches from Israel in any kind of radical way. And he never considered that he converted to a different religion. He was just continuing as a prophet of the God of Israel.
Hmm.
But I don't get hung up on saying, well, then I'm not going to use the word Christian for Paul's churches or for the people in his churches. Yes, it's anachronistic to use it of Paul.
But as long as we understand that.
Yeah, I don't believe history is ever without anachronism.
Yeah.
It's just there can be helpful anachronisms. Anachronisms we're aware of. What we need to avoid is anachronisms that we're not aware of.
Yeah, naive anachronisms.
Exactly.
And you've already sort of touched on my next question there, because I was going to ask if you could describe what happens to the study of the New Testament when you're informed by those concerns, the set of concerns around the historicization of the category of religion. And so, for example, yes, there's been a lot of sort of recent energy in biblical studies trying to understand the relationship between, quote-unquote, Paul and Judaism.
Mm-hmm.
So what then happens to the study of Paul or to the study of Judaism when you realize that Paul would never have made that distinction himself?
I think the first thing it does is it de-emphasizes the centrality of theology.
Interesting.
I don't want to get rid of theology. I think it's important to talk about what did Paul mean by sin? What did Paul mm-hmm. mean by God the Father? What did Paul mean by the Holy Spirit? But instead of moving very quickly to theological ways of thinking about that, you then move to comparative ways of thinking about it.
Yeah, sure.
To saying something like, why did Paul build his churches the way he did? Why did he try to network them through letter writing? You start reading Paul more as an organizer.
Sure.
You know, a, a, something like a union organizer
yeah.
or something like that. Or you see him trying to deal with issues of ethnicity when the world has changed, if the Messiah has already come,
yeah.
and especially if that Messiah has been crucified, which mm-hmm. was not supposed to happen.
Yeah.
So it de-emphasizes some of the theological ways of thinking so much. And even when you deal with issues that are theological, it tends to put them more in the realm of culture and ideology and power and society. And that's one thing it does. Now, I was already doing that,
yeah.
in a sense, before we started this critical analysis of the word religion. I came to Yale as a PhD student precisely because I wanted to work with Wayne Meeks,
mm-hmm.
who in the 70s was trying to push the social history of yep. early Christianity, which, again, took theological themes, but then said, what's the social function mm-hmm. of this theological theme or this theological doctrine? What did it mean to think that you were citizens of a different polis?
Yeah.
As, you know, both Peter, the letter of Peter will talk about, and then Paul talks about. What did it mean to say to the Philippians, our politouma, our citizenship, our constitutionality, is in a different place?
Mm-hmm.
So it doesn't get rid of the theology. It just means you have the social function of the theology.
Mm-hmm.
So I was doing it before I got rid of religion, in a sense. But I think trying to think outside of the category of religion just does that a bit more.
Mm-hmm. And to what extent do you think that's happening in biblical studies as a discipline at large, at a sort of a global level, so to speak, or at least within Western academic institutions, whether secular universities or seminaries?
I think it's really going great guns. One of the things that seems to be the most popular right now is post-colonial studies.
Mm-hmm.
So looking at the early churches less as centered around certain theological beliefs and more as either resisting or accommodating empire.
Mm-hmm.
So and that is a way that's also anachronistic, because quite often people
yeah.
completely introduce modern democratic principles,
mm-hmm.
Notions of liberty and freedom, equality, or even things like the notion of a principle of nonviolence,
mm-hmm.
whereas I don't believe there was ever a principle of nonviolence in the ancient world.
Yeah.
Even people who said turn you the cheek, they weren't advocating nonviolence as an abstract principle, because they believed that God was going to sweep in
yeah,
and
sure.
cause a whole lot of violence,
yeah.
probably. So there's no such thing as a principle of nonviolence in the ancient world, and I think sometimes taking modern political conceptions and themes and moving those backward, that's also then going to be anachronistic.
Sure.
But certainly, post-colonialism, studies of gender and sexuality in the ancient world, the construction of gender and sexuality in early Christianity, the study of asceticism
mm-hmm.
as a cultural phenomenon that is not separate from prior Roman elite ways of fashioning the self.
Yeah.
These are things that are going, you know, fashioning the self was big yeah. in the 80s and 90s and the new historicism in English departments and Shakespeare studies.
Yeah.
And you just see, the kinds of things you see going on a lot in biblical studies is the same kind of thing that's going on in a lot of other parts of the humanities.
Sure, sure. Well, to change tack a little now.
And I should say, not just the humanities. You have a lot of interest right now in cognitive science and how that relates
to
in the study of religion. And we have a student here who thinks that I'm going to give him an exam tomorrow. And mm-hmm. one of the questions on his comprehensive is to talk about recent developments in cognitive science and how those relate to epistemology
mm-hmm.
and then how that might relate to religious epistemology. Because
mm-hmm.
there have been scientists who've been studying this stuff. Or I have another student who's using scientific notions of emergence theory
mm-hmm.
For his dissertation. But he's ending up talking about this helps us think about Paul and sin
mm-hmm.
in new ways.
So fascinating.
So there are also, we try to push here at Yale, especially through the Terry lectures, which are lectures on science and religion that mm-hmm. happen every year, and through some of our interests, we try to say, well, we in the humanities can learn things from issues that are coming up in the sciences also.
Yeah. Well, to change tack a little, I wanted to ask you about a lot of criticism that has been directed against the field of religious studies, with the charge being that many scholars of religion, perhaps most, depending which critic you talk to, are doing descriptive phenomenological work that is effectively a form of what they often call ecumenical apologetics, given the way in which scholars tend to reinforce a fluffy notion that religion, quote-unquote, which is a category we've already problematized, is, quote-unquote, a good thing, in a way that tends to suppress the political issues that sort of constitute and pervade all forms of representation. And one scholar of high standing at the recent AAR meeting even described this to me by saying that religious studies scholars often claim the prestige of the university whilst playing by the rules of the seminary. So given your long experience in the field, I wanted to ask you a few questions on this. Firstly being, if you think it's a fair criticism, and if so, how does it play out in the level of a scholar's methodology, if they are succumbing to that tendency, and how does it play out in the structures of the field, the academic field more broadly? I'm thinking access to funding, the hiring process, tenure, things like that.
It may just be that I just am working and living in different circles from the scholar you mentioned, but that's not been my experience in the 25 years or so I've been teaching in religious studies departments. Now, it may well be that if you just took especially biblical scholars...
I'm going to ask you about this a little later.
...that the discipline of biblical studies probably has more than its share of Christians and even more conservatives than the other fields. But I personally have not known... I knew one professor who taught Buddhism, who taught it almost from a sort of practicing position. But the people here who teach our courses in Asian religions are not themselves really religious, and they don't teach their Buddhism courses or their Hinduism courses or Sanskrit or anything like that. I don't see them teaching these things from anything except much more like, say, an anthropologist would teach another culture. Or the people we have who teach Islamic studies, they're not Muslims, and they're not apologizing. Now, of course, one thing that I think we in religious studies do, but I think it's a good thing, is we try to get our students to see how some kind of religious practice or a belief system or structure or rituals aren't simply crazy. We want them to be able to look at it. In fact, I often say religious studies is very good at trying to take students to something that will seem completely bizarre and unbelievable initially to the students, and insist that if we keep looking at it, if we keep studying it, we can see how it could be rational.
You begin to understand the cultural logic.
Exactly. So I think that's important. So we don't want our students to come to any religious tradition or text without some attempt to understand it as believers could understand it. But we certainly don't do that trying to convince them of its truth. So I would say that in the schools I've taught at Duke and now Yale, I just don't see that happening.
Would that perhaps be because they're really high quality schools? I'm just thinking of the fact that you get people like Russell McCutcheon and Timothy Fitzgerald really making that point quite firmly. Often, I feel, without many examples, beyond perhaps citing Eliade or someone.
Right.
But they are quite insistent that religious studies as a discipline is borders on crypto-theology a lot of the time, which I've never been entirely convinced of. But
I don't see it happening in the circles that I move in. In fact, I got into a big argument several people in the religious studies department at Dartmouth, which doesn't have really a PhD program, so they're mainly, but it's a secular department that tries to represent, you know, the different major religions and the theoretical and methodological study of religion itself in a comparative and open way. And one of the things that we fought about at this dinner, I mean, it was a friendly fight, but it was a very, there were strong feelings on both sides, was some of them objected to the fact that I don't try to hide the fact that I go to church.
Yeah.
And one of the professors, in fact, she was saying, you really have something that I don't have. She's Jewish, but she's atheist. And so when she's offering critical study of the Bible, the Hebrew Bible, the conservative student, religious students in her class can just dismiss her and say, oh, well, she's an atheist anyway.
Yeah.
So why should we accept what she says?
Yeah.
Whereas she was saying that I was pulling another trick. What I was doing to students was saying, well, they'd say, are you a Christian? I'd say, well, yeah, I go to church, you know. And they'd say, but here you are portraying Paul in these unbelievable ways that, you know, he doesn't believe in marriage. He doesn't believe in, you know, he believes you should have sex with your wife, but without desiring her. And how, you know, how can you present these unbelievable things about early Christianity and offer these strong criticisms of the, for example, the authorship of most of the New Testament documents? How can you do that? If you could? So I can, but I can actually make a more critical approach to the New Testament, more defensible by letting them know that I still go to church. Mm-hmm. Well, some of the other people in this department just thought that was terrible. Mm. They just thought any attempt, any student should be able to get out of a whole course of yours having not one idea about what you believe. Mm. I got in the same argument, though, with political scientists here, who they objected when I gave a lecture for a course on Augustine. Mm-hmm. And basically, I kind of defended some of Augustine's theology, because I said, if you really want to understand Augustine's politics, you have to understand his theology, because mm-hmm. it's all wrapped up in his worldview and what his view of human nature and everything.
Of course.
And they got upset because they thought I was defending Augustine's theology too much. Mm.
They're not used to it, I guess.
And they said, well, they in political science, they try to, you know, never let students know how they vote or what they believe politically. And I said, well, that's fine, but you are you're communicating values to your students. You're communicating ideology. Mm-hmm. And I just believe in being upfront when I'm doing it.
Yeah, I would agree.
And they really had this, what I consider a very naive idea, that they could present a purely objective kind of face, even when talking about politics, which is a very value-laden topic.
Yeah.
I basically said, I think you're fooling yourself, guys. Mm. But I don't think we face this problem with religion any more than in a lot of other topics.
Yeah.
I mean, look, the modern universities are basically middle-of-the-road liberalism. Mm-hmm. They're not. Most of the faculty aren't as radical leftist as I am.
Yeah.
Most of them are not as, say, anti-foundationalist postmodern as mm-hmm. I am. But they're going to communicate that democracy is a fairly good thing, mm-hmm. equality is good, mm-hmm. open societies are good. Well, these are values.
Yeah.
And for people to act like they're not values is just dishonest.
This is, it's almost, that's the problem with the whole idea of secularism being a neutral space, as if it's not value laden, to which you add religion or another commitment on.
Yeah, so I see, if someone says that religious studies departments are full of people who are basically apologizing for religion, I would just say, well, then probably no more than people in English departments and history departments and political science departments are apologizing for modern liberalism.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's a really interesting way to understand. And that flows well into the next question that I want to ask you, which is that I want to know if you agree with the idea that there's no such thing as apolitical scholarship. And it sounds like you don't. All scholarship is political to a degree. And even, I would argue, the choice to not situate yourself politically is in itself a form of political choice.
Yeah. In fact, that's liberalism.
That's liberalism, yeah, precisely. The sort of fallacy of neutrality, in a way. But I wanted to ask if the people who are sort of commonly called religionists, which will be the, I guess, the kind of people who Russell McCutcheon and Tim Fitzgerald have in mind when they make the criticism of apologetic tendencies, do those scholars, the religionists, reinforce normative regimes of truth by their very suppression of political concerns? So do they, for example, by their problematic conception that religion is a sui generis phenomenon that can be studied on its own, effectively shelter religious discourse from the challenges to Western discourse at large that have been offered over the past 30, 40 years by critical theorists?
Yeah, I think they would, but, you know, I don't know anybody like that.
Sure.
Yeah, Eliade was that way. I get popular questions all the time about, I can't call his name, who's the guy that was on TV a lot, on public TV?
Houston Smith?
No, more recent than that. He was kind of doing Eliade-type TV stuff and was, I can't think of his name right now, but not Campbell. Maybe it was Campbell. Joseph Campbell?
Yeah, I can't recall.
Maybe it was his name, Joseph Campbell. You know, there was a big public TV series where he's talking about religions and trying to say there are these deep things that all religions share. And
yeah.
He's been very, very famous as something of an apologist for religion.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know anybody in any religious studies department that I'm aware of who takes that seriously.
Who's that critically naive?
I think much more interesting are people like Jeff Kripal at Rice University, who he's advocating that what we really need to do is at least be open to the idea that the paranormal exists.
Mm-hmm.
That when people say they've experienced, you know, demonic possession or miracles or going into a paranormal state of consciousness, that we at least take it seriously.
Yeah, sure.
He's doing that, but he's not doing it in defense of Roman Catholicism or anything like that. He's doing it in saying we need to be more open-minded and not so scientific or not so secularist oriented.
Yeah.
We need to be actually really open to the idea that there may be religious experiences that truly exist.
Yeah.
Now that's considered a radical position.
Yeah.
But that's closer to the Iliada kind of approach.
It is. It's very interesting. It's almost come full circle in a way where the sort of Eliadan approach is now fused with the more, say, critical perspective that's attuned to those political questions, like post-colonial and post-structuralist concerns.
Right, exactly.
But that gives it, I guess, a little more legitimacy, perhaps.
Or people who say, one of my students has traveled around Africa a lot, and he really believes that, you know, we ought to at least pay attention to the way Africans study the New Testament. Precisely because they live in a world that has demons in it. They're really worried about demons and exorcisms. Yeah. So they're going to read these gospel passages differently. Now, so this is coming from this is almost a critical position that's critical of Western ideas about religion, precisely by trying to be more open-minded. So those are the kind of people that I think are closer, not your normal person in a religious studies department, who kind of puts all decisions about whether this is true or not on the shelf.
Mm-hmm.
That's my experience. And they're much just as much interesting in saying, you know, we need to study the witch trials. We need to study the Crusades. We need to study, the fact that Augustine talks about love, but then in the end he wants the emperor to suppress the Donatists if necessary by killing them. We know about this stuff, and so we usually talk about this stuff. And by the time students get out of our class, I don't think they have romantic notions that religion is always a good thing.
Okay, very interesting. And so I guess a final question then, which will in a way recap what we've just gone over, is whether you think that the approach to the study of religion made popular by Eliada and co, the kind of history of religion school where religion was understood as something that required its own specific kind of hermeneutical approach, whether we've made significant strides in the last sort of couple of decades by entering more of a conversation with the wider kind of humanities and sciences.
I think so. I think that the fact is right now, it's not just that we have changed in the past 30 years, although religious studies departments have changed in the past 30 years. And I think that can be empirically verifiable. They've become more like humanities departments in general and less like seminaries.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just, you can just look at their curriculum, you can look at their personnel, you can look at the methods they use. But also, what's interesting is that now more than ever, especially since 9/11, but nobody, even in the sciences, questions the importance for the comparative study of religion.
Mm.
So you've got biologists who are trying to float theories of how evolutionary biology explains how religion came about. You have people in cognitive science trying to do to explain religious belief through computerized models and mapping the brain. So now the study of religion is something that is never questioned. 50 years ago, people in a secular university would have more likely said, "Why do we need religious studies departments? That's for seminaries and divinity schools to do." But that's totally changed, and you won't find anybody. I haven't found anybody in the last 20 years who questions the need for the secular comparative study of religion, whether in the humanities or the social sciences or the sciences. They're all studying religion.
So I guess we could say you've got a very optimistic sort of prognosis for the future of the interdisciplinary study of religion.
I just see it happening. I mean, I have scientists all the time who want to talk to me about their theories about religion and religious belief. And so I think that it's... in fact, I also tell our graduate students who are worried about the job market. Now, it may be this is less true for biblical studies than for, say, Islamic studies. But I've said, look around. It's not universities are not downsizing their religious studies departments. Mm-hmm. They may downsize classics. They may be not having a German department anymore. They may not, the Slavic studies may be downsized, but they're building religious studies. And so the study of religion right now is a growth industry overall in the United States. I don't think it's true in Europe and other places, but that's also true in Europe. It's mostly theology. It's, if they're in a theological faculty, but the U.S., but most of these schools went to having religious studies departments in arts and sciences programs, and they're growing. The University of Texas, a school of 50,000 students, founded a religious studies department there only about 5 years ago.
Right.
And they're starting new PhD programs there. Mm-hmm. They believe, and they're not doing everything. They're not, you know, they don't teach theology, for example, but they're doing Latin America. They're doing Mayan stuff. They're doing, and they also have Mediterranean, ancient Mediterranean, Judaic studies, biblical studies, archaeology, and material culture of the ancient world. So I'm optimistic, at least for the time being, that religious studies as a secular comparative discipline is actually becoming a discipline, not disappearing.
Great. Well, unfortunately, that's all we have time for today. It's been a fascinating discussion from someone with a great deal of expertise. It's been a real pleasure talking with you. So on behalf of the Religious Studies Project, I'd like to thank you greatly for your time this afternoon.
You're very welcome.
Thanks, Dale.
So you've just been listening to Jack Summers of Macquarie University speaking with Dale Martin on the topic of the relationship between religious studies and biblical studies. And David and I are still in the White Hart in Edinburgh. Of course, with the illusions of podcastery, we've just gone straight into this. David and I wanted to tell you just a little bit more about what was coming out with the next series of podcasts. But first of all, I should mention, because we've cut our standard introductory spiel and want to make it a bit more conversational, a bit different, that it is important that every episode that we mention the British Association for the Study of Religions, who've been very generous right from the word go, with, you know, giving us their name and giving us financial support there, and just really promoting everything that we're doing. So this podcast has been presented in association with them, and we'd just like to acknowledge the British Association for everything they've done for us. I'll let David maybe tell you a bit about the sort of next phase of the project, and then I shall tell you specifically about next week's interview.
Well, the next few weeks, we're not sure quite whether it's going to be 3 or 4, with still a bit of rearranging going on behind the scenes. It's going to be a series on religion in a global context. So we're looking, first of all, at Mormonism. Our podcast with Ryan Cragen talks about growth and decline of Mormonism in the European context, but we should have a response on Wednesday talking about Mormonism in an Eastern European context as a sort of balance of that, which is going to be very interesting. We also have an interview with Peter Baer, which we're very excited about, on religion and globalization. And there's a couple of others that we're still playing around with, but those are going to be the next few weeks. After that, we will probably have a round table, which was recorded in Australia by our friend Carol Cusack, on publishing in a religious studies context. And then after that, we're intending to have a series on psychology of religion, which has been kind of masterminded by another one of our new interviewers, Chris Silver. But we'll have more about that in a week or two to come. But that's the next kind of month and a half sketched out. We've got lots of other interviews lined up. We've got a lot of others recorded. We've got even more lined up and a lot of exciting developments down the line. But for just now, I'm going to pass you over to Chris for next a little preview of next week's interview.
Yes. Well, next week we'll be talking with Ryan Cragen, who is based at the University of Tampa, and he is a sociologist. And what we get next week is a really interesting mix of qualitative and quantitative work. work because primarily Ryan is a quantitative sociologist, so there's a lot of statistics, but he also engages with things in depth interviews and thinking a bit more reflexively about those statistics. So certainly I think David and I would think of him as an exception to the rule in that he is a quantitative sociologist who really does engage deeply with those questions of classification and what happens at an individual level. In terms of Mormonism, he is our first podcast on that, so we start off with an introduction to Mormonism in general, and then we get into the sort of specifics, demographics, and taking it out of a US context, where we don't really think about Mormonism outside of a US context at all, but it is very vibrant, and they would certainly portray themselves as one of the most growing religions in the world, but as you will see, maybe that is not as nuanced as it should be. And then also, there's a really interesting dynamic which Ryan talks about with being himself an ex-Mormon, and how you go about studying Mormonism and presenting your research while still maintaining a neutral stance. So that's what we've got coming up for you next week. For now, I think we're probably just going to sign off and let you know, of course, the Facebook page has been really lively over the holiday period. You can check us out, search the Religious Studies Project. You find us on Twitter at ProjectRS. Look us up on iTunes. And apart from that, I think all that is left to say is thanks for listening.